Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today on Behind the Knife, we continue with Dr. Kenji and Naba, part two. And today we focus specifically on the tips and tricks of penetrating neck trauma. But first, our random fact of the day. All right, well, St. Patrick's Day right around the corner. A common theme in the United States is to turn the rivers green. This first started in Chicago. Jason, how did this start?
Yeah, so interestingly, back in the 1960s, Chicago was having a major problem with pollution in the Chicago River. And the river was basically a public toilet. So in an effort to identify where the dumping was occurring, the mayor of Chicago at the time had authorized pouring a green dye into the river in order to identify the point where the dumping was coming from. But it was a childhood friend of the mayor's, Stephen Bailey, who had the bright idea, being a St. Patrick's Day parade chairman, that if we could turn part of the river green for a short period of time, why couldn't we turn the entire river green? So he got the idea to start doing this for St. Patrick's Day and dumped a total of 100 pounds of green dye into the river and turned the entire thing green. Now, this eventually got the ecologically friendly people all up in arms because this was an oil-based dye that many thought could damage the environment. And so, Kevin, how did that evolve into what we're now doing today?
Well, one thing you forgot to mention is that the 100 pounds of dye actually turned the river green for an entire week. So they've titrated down, and now they're down to 25 pounds of dye, which is the perfect formula. But yeah, so after the environmentalists were up in arms about the fluorescent dye going in the river and causing future problems, they were able to develop a vegetable-based dye. And the actual formula is kept a secret, but it is an orange powder until it hits the water. In 2003, one of the parade organizers told a reporter that revealing the formula would be akin to telling where the leprechaun hides its gold.
So today, the dyeing process begins approximately 9:15 on the morning of the Chicago St. Patrick's Parade. This starts with a larger boat that heads out in the water and essentially sifts this orange powder into the dye using flour sifters. Then a smaller boat follows on behind to disperse the substance, and about 45 minutes later, the Chicago River is green. And that has been your random fact of the day.
Okay, now it's time for our tips and tricks segment. This is the segment of the podcast where we ask our experts to give us some advice on getting out of those more tricky situations. And today we're very excited. We have Dr. Martin with us, a longtime friend of the podcast, who's going to lead Dr. Inaba and his former pupil, Dr. Mo, through a scenario related to penetrating neck trauma.
Okay, penetrating neck trauma, one of my favorite topics, and I think one that's important because a lot has evolved, and I think there's still a lot of misconceptions out there about how to do modern state-of-the-art management of penetrating neck trauma. So we're going to do this as a scenario, and you're the staff on call, Kenji. You're at a smaller hospital, so you're at home, and your resident is in the hospital, and he's calling you with a patient that just came in. And unfortunately, your resident tonight is Dr. Mo.
Am I allowed to change residence art?
Hello, sir. You there?
Yes.
Sir, we have a patient here in the ER. Sir, patient in the trauma bay right now. He's 25, healthy, and he's got a stab wound to his neck. I'm not sure where to start, sir.
I'm not surprised that you don't know where to start, but what do you think you would want to do? That's the question. So
detailed history and physical exam, sir.
I like it. Good answer. So yeah. So you know, I think that you know, years ago, before the advent of the CT angiogram, I think the first thing that any resident calling their staff would have said was, "It's a stab wound. There's one or multiple, and where they're located." And I think probably in 2016, you would probably tell us like in what zone the injury would be located in. But as I'm sure we'll uncover in this, it really doesn't impact our management anymore. You know, back before the era of CT angio, the zones were very important for how we proceeded with our investigations or trip to the operating room, because as you remember, zone two is just so easy to access, and zones one and three are not. But yeah, so I think I agree. The first step would be a detailed history and especially the physical exam.
patient has a single stab wound to zone 1 of the neck, unknown length of the blade, and the knife is not with the patient.
All right, perfect. And what other things would we maybe want to be interested in knowing about on that physical exam?
Well, certainly you would look for blood from the mouth, either coughing or spitting up blood, subcutaneous emphysema, stridor, and hard signs of vascular injury or hemodynamic instability given the proximity to structures in the chest.
Definitely. So, yeah, you know, I think when I get that phone call, you know, where I work, we go down, but I guess we're in a setting where I'm at home. I would really want to know for this patient all the things that you told me, but compartmentalized into, do they have hard signs of injury, soft signs of injury, or no signs at all of injury? And I think for the extremity and the neck, really all of our examination can get categorized into that. Because if the patient has hard signs of either a vascular or aerodigestive tract injury, we know that they're going to go straight up to the operating room. If they have no signs other than that little skin stab wound, we know that they most likely can be observed and sent home, whereas everybody with a soft sign is going to get imaging. And in 2016, the imaging modality of choice is the screen would be a CT angiogram.
Well, this patient certainly doesn't have any of the hard signs of vascular injury. They're not asymptomatic. There's some continued bleeding from the incision. They've got maybe a little bit of difficulty with their breathing.
Okay. So, yeah, I think that that's probably the most important thing. And I think the biggest take-home message when we talk about tips or tricks for dealing with penetrating neck injuries is, do they fit into one of those categories? And just to review, and you guys can cut this out if you want, but the hard signs. So like you said, anyone that's hemodynamically unstable or in shock and you're attributing it to the neck injury, that's a classic hard sign, and they need to have that explored. Correct. Anyone that has active arterial bleeding, or they have a contained hematoma, but that hematoma is
expanding,
really big, or it's expanding or whatever, that's very worrisome to all of us. And anyone that has any unilateral neurologic symptoms where you think that, like in the extremity, there's an occlusion and no pulse below, but in this situation, there's no flow to the brain, that would be a classic hard sign. And then just for completeness sake, a brewery or a thrill, I guess, would be the other one that we often don't see, but we want to make sure is in that list. And then the soft signs, of course, like you said, are everything in between nothing. So that and the hard signs. And for the aerodigestive tract, really what we're talking about when we talk about hard signs is massive hemoptysis or massive hematemesis or any frank air that's bubbling out of the wound itself. And those are really the classic hard signs. And so I think if you see any of those, the yield is going to be very high and you can head off straight to the operating room, and everyone else in between should go for a CT angiogram.
Oh, well, very good, sir. Unfortunately, it's 10 a.m. and I was the overnight resident. You're my program director, so, sir, you understand I have to leave. While you were talking, I gave the sign out here to Dr. McClellan, though. Here he is.
Those damn work hours.
Yeah, I didn't get to drink my Starbucks yet, but I heard he has a stab injury or something like that. But yeah, well, I have this patient in front of me, sir. I think he's doing okay. I'm not sure exactly what injuries we have. I think I'm about getting some studies. You have any recommendations?
Yeah, so I think that is something that really has changed over the last couple of years. There are several good studies out there right now looking specifically at the sensitivity and the specificity of CT angiogram. And I think if you combine that with the burden of getting the traditional imaging that we would have, so again, for the vascular system, it would have been a four-vessel runoff catheter-based angiogram. It would have been a swallow scope because the cervical esophagus is very difficult to look at, and DL and bronchoscopy, a huge burden of tests that is both time-consuming and expensive. All of that, I think, in 2016 has been supplanted by a single screening test, which is a CT angiogram. All of the studies use a quad scanner or above, which virtually every institution has access to, and it all uses peripherally based IV contrast in a load that's very similar or less than what would be required for a four-vessel runoff angiogram. And we know that for vascular injuries, the sensitivity and the specificity are extremely high for vascular injuries. So if it has excluded an injury and it's normal, you probably can send that patient home. And on the flip side, if it shows an injury, you can feel very comfortable in proceeding directly to the operating room without getting a confirmatory angiogram. Now, for the aerodigestive tract, the sensitivity across all of the studies that have been done is really good. So basically, if that stab wound or gunshot wound is there on the CT scan, but there's no evidence of a tracheal or a digestive tract injury, you're good to go. The likelihood that you've got a missed injury that's clinically significant is extremely low, and that patient can be sent home. Now, the only place that I think the CT angio falls a little bit short is the patient that comes in and has a stab wound, or it could be a gunshot wound, and there's a couple bubbles of air, maybe a tiny little bit of fluid nearby the aerodigestive tract. And the read's going to come back to you as, you know, it's equivocal for an esophageal or it's equivocal for an airway injury, can't rule out. And I think that those findings will degrade the specificity of the exam for the aerodigestive tract, and those are the patients that may need to go on to get the definitive testing. So I think the summary is that in 2016, hard signs can go directly to the operating room. No signs can go to observation and home. Everyone with a soft sign should proceed to CT angiogram as your first test of choice. The ability for it to exclude injuries is very good. 100% sensitivity across all large studies for both the aerodigestive tract as well as for vascular injuries. If it's negative, they're done. If it's positive for a vascular injury, because the specificity is so high, you can feel comfortable operating on those patients. For those patients where the read comes out as can't exclude an esophageal, tracheal, aerodigestive tract injury, those are the patients, because the specificity is not perfect, that may need to go on for confirmatory testing.
Well, he got back from CT scan, and I'm looking at him right now. We do have some air coming from the wound. It's funny you mentioned that. What should I do now? Do I need to call the OR and tell them we're coming?
Yeah, I think if there is air bubbling from the wound, you know, whether you find it before the CAT scan, or, you know, in which case you can skip the CAT scan, or you find it afterwards, that's a good indication to go to the operating room and explore that region to exclude and or repair a tracheal injury.
So this patient has a pulsatile hematoma. It's on the left side, right where the stab wound is. What do we do with them next?
Yeah, so that again is a classic hard sign, and you know, every resident at our institution, and I'm sure at yours, would be happy to have a patient like that in the operating room, because that's a direct ticket up to the OR. And, you know, we, as everyone else does, we'll start with a standard anterior sternocleidomastoid incision and proceed down and directly access that hematoma to see what it is that's bleeding. If there's a gunshot wound tract or a stab wound, it's nice to just follow that right down and access that bleeding.
Okay. And so tell us, you have an injury to the common carotid. What's your operation of choice?
So I think that it really depends in this situation on what the status of the patient is. And you know, if the patient is unstable at all, or, you know, they're proceeding towards the point where they're going to become unstable, or they have a high associated burden of injuries, where if you start tackling everything that's life-threatening will make them unstable, we will proceed and just shunt that patient. You know, there's a lot of choices that you have. We stock at LA County the Argyle shunt pack, and usually for an adult, common, the largest shunt would work perfectly, and that's what we would do. Get them back to the ICU and resuscitate them.
Okay. Now, if they're stable?
If they're stable, we will proceed directly to getting that taken care of and reconstructing it. And in general, all of the principles that we would normally follow for vascular anastomosis hold in this trauma situation. And we would then, you know, expose the artery, get good proximal distal control. And, you know, many stab wounds are amenable to debridement and primary repair. Most gunshot wounds are the flip opposite, and they are not amenable to that. And, you know, unlike the subclavian injuries that we were discussing earlier this morning, there's really a mix of size ranges when it comes to males versus females, younger versus the adult patients. And so I think the choice of conduit, whether it's a PTFE or a reverse saphenous vein, will really depend on the clinical situation that you're in. And so, you know, all patients that come in with these penetrating neck injuries, you need to have everything prepped and ready to go to harvest vein as required.
Okay, so you had this stab wound, and there was some air, a little bit of air bubbling out of the wound. You got the CT scan, and there was air next to the esophagus. You got a swallow, and there's some contrast extravasation into the left neck, small amount.
So, you know, that's a good question. I know what you're trying to get at, and I think there are groups in, for example, South Africa. That,
I don't know what I'm trying to get at. I wonder what you know.
there are groups that might consider managing one of these small, the sort of injury that you're describing, esophageal injuries non-operatively. In our practice, we don't do that. If you were to show me a CT scan with contrast extravasating, or a swallow with contrast extravasating, and you know, with these contrast swallows, it takes a fair amount of contrast in order to visualize something for the cervical esophagus. We would take these patients directly to the operating room and repair that injury. I think it's very important for the stab wound that you describe, or with gunshot wounds, despite the fact that there's a normal CT angiogram, we will expose and look at the trachea in that area, and we will expose and look at the vascular structures in that area as well. And I think the other sort of thing to remember with these stab wounds, although it doesn't happen often just because of the way that the esophagus lies anatomically, that there would be an anterior type wound and then a posterior type wound. But I think as best as possible, as long as, you know, especially, or not as long as, but if it's especially a large wound, that you ensure that there is no secondary injury to the esophagus on the posterior side. And then, you know, the repair is very straightforward. You know, I think all trauma surgeons love doing this operation because it's very straightforward and it's very satisfying. So, you know, we would do a single layer repair with an absorbable suture and, get that dealt with. Try very hard to lay some muscle down on top of that in order to protect that repair. And, you know, the question of drainage always comes up. I had this exact injury 2 nights ago just before I flew up here, and, you know, I laid a small Blake drain down there. That's my practice, and... you know, it is what it is. The patient's extubated now, are doing well, and they'll start on some sips of fluid hopefully today. I'm waiting for a text message from the residents to see how they're doing, but I always do routinely leave a drain for these injuries.
Well, that's been shown to be the best prevention for insomnia for the trauma surgeon. So yeah, I agree. Yeah. I would always leave a drain for those esophageal injuries.
Yep.
So is there anybody that you're going to take to the OR based just on mechanism?
Is there anyone that I'm going to take to the... That's a really good question. I'm just thinking through that right now. I don't know that... You know, if they have a hard sign, that is an immediate ticket to get into the operating room. Maybe the only other patient that might come up... as you know, from the CT angio literature looking specifically at penetrating neck injuries, one of the most challenging mechanisms is the shotgun injury. And, you know, if you look at all of the series, including the one that we did with shock trauma and our single center studies, I mean, the reality is almost all of the patients in which there was artifact and they could not give us a ruling on the CT angio, they were all due to shotgun injuries. And the pellets just leave so much scatter and artifact. So, there's a couple ways to approach that patient. One would be to, you can try the CT angio, and if you can't get a read on it and it's the artifact is obscuring the vasculature, you may go on in these patients to do the traditional backup or confirmatory testing. The reality is, as you know, in many patients, because of the burden of metal that's in the neck, even that becomes difficult. So I think that may be the one patient, you know, with soft signs, especially if there's a lot of soft tissue damage and you want to debride the muscle in that area anyways, and you know the skin's going to necrose there, the relatively close range shotgun injuries, which unfortunately we do get to see a fair number of in Los Angeles. I would say that may be the one patient that you bring him to the operating room, and in as part of your, you know, debridement of the skin and the soft tissues, you inspect the vasculature to make sure that that's okay, and you can check their digestive tract as well. And again, these are patients that have some soft signs, some oozing in that area, which invariably they have. It may be the safest way to ensure that you, you know, haven't got any damage in there. And I think that, you know, it's a good question because you can see how I was really shying away from the fact that, you know, we don't want to take anybody just based on the injury itself. And you know, we've really come to that point where if there's not a hard sign telling us to go to the operating room or a CT angio that tells us we need to go to the operating room, that we really hesitate to go. But I think it's a good question, because there are situations where you cannot rely on the imaging and you have to go back to the basic principles and do the operative exploration.
Now, and some people have argued that you should take every true transcervical gunshot wound, because the incidence of an injury is so high. So what would you do? You have a true transcervical, straight across, hole on each side.
So I'm going to agree that, yes, the likelihood that there's a clinically significant injury is very high. I would say absolutely that's true. But I think that there are two other things that I take into consideration in answering that not every transcervical gunshot wound needs to go directly to the operating room. And the first is that a large surface area or internal volume of the neck is made up by the spinal column. And so getting a CT angiogram ahead of time to kind of ascertain what the spinal injuries are, I think, is a useful thing. And in the patient that doesn't have hard signs telling you that you definitely need to go to the operating room, I think the second thing is that there is a chance that this has gone through in a plane where there is not a clinically significant injury. So the way that we approach things with transcervical gunshot wounds is that we put them through the same question. Do they have hard signs, soft signs, or no signs of injury? It's usually relatively unlikely for them to have no signs of injury. And so they almost always will fall into the hard signs or the soft signs category. And if they fall into the soft signs category, you know, we will always get a CT scan ahead of time. The reality is it lets you look at the spine, it lets you look at everything that's in there. And, you know, the other thing that I think is useful is that, you know, if the trajectory of the bullet was such that now you have two holes in the neck, right? If the trajectory of the bullet is such that it, you know, and clinically it's very difficult for us to tell if it's an entrance wound or an exit wound. If one of the holes, let's say on the left side, is associated with an IJ or carotid injury, and then it passes through the bony mass, and on the right side of the neck there is no injury, you know that when you go to the operating room, you do not have to do a bilateral cut down and bilateral exploration. All you really have to do is a left-sided exposure. So I think for that reason also, it's very useful to get that CT angiogram ahead of time. So I think to answer your question, heart signs, transcervical gunshot wound, direct to operating room. If they've got soft signs, I would still proceed to CT angio to get that extra information for operative planning, to look at the spine and to really see what's injured, or if nothing's injured, before going to the operating room. And based on that, it would help us make some decisions that we'll enact intraoperatively.
All right. Now, this patient has 6 stab wounds on both sides of the neck, and they're hemodynamically unstable.
Yeah, that you know, and we do get that, you know. Unfortunately, I would say, yeah, those patients are going to go directly to the operating room. The instability would make us skip everything and run upstairs as fast as we can, and that patient's getting a bilateral neck.
So how are you going to explore them? Are you going to do bilateral anterior SCM incisions? Are you going to do a big collar incision?
Yeah, so in my experience, you know, unfortunately, I find the collar incision very limiting. In the up-down plane. So as a direct result of that, my favorite approach is to do bilateral sternocleidomastoid incisions, knowing that if there's something more central, you can simply bring that incision across. So in a way, it's like a modified, very acute collar incision. But because a collar incision really limits, without making big skin flaps, how high or how low you can go, I always favor doing bilateral sternocleidomastoid incisions. And, you know, as we talked about in Grand Rounds today, the reality is unfortunate, especially in those patients that come in with multiple stab wounds and you don't have the benefit of imaging ahead of time, it is very easy and not uncommon for one of those stab wounds to traverse further down into the mediastinum to hit, for example, the subclavian artery or the vein or the innominate on the right side. I mean, these are things that can happen. And if you've got a nice sternocleidomastoid incision, not only can you bring those together to deal with anterior tracheal injuries, you can extend those downwards into a sternotomy to really access your mediastinal structures. So my favorite approach would be bilateral sternocleidomastoid incisions.
All right, well, that wasn't fair, because you automatically jumped into my next question. That was going to be a low zone 1 pulsatile bleeding, which you already answered. Convert to median sternotomy. All right, now the last scenario, you've got active arterial bleeding coming posteriorly up from your incision. And so it looks like it's probably a vertebral artery injury. So tell us how you deal with that.
So, again, you know, that is a great question. So, and I'll tell you that the case that I had the night before was an interesting one in that the IJ was transected right, you know, there's a big, you know, venous injury right at the base of the skull. And as you and I both know, that is, for us, one of the most challenging areas for any penetrating neck injury. So a mediastinal injury, or if it's an innominate, or if it's a subclavian, those are very straightforward. You just extend that down into a median sternotomy, and you have full-on unimpeded access to all the structures down there. That does not stress any of us out. But when the blood is coming from a structure where the blood is exiting from the base of the skull, that is a challenge for any of us to get a hold of. So in the situation that you're present, if you get stuck and they have true hard signs and you're in the operating room, you're stuck. And you need to do your very best to get that dealt with. I think that if you do know this in the situation that you're giving me preoperatively, and you can occlude that bleeding and you're very worried that it's a posterior injury and it's well away from where the carotid is, another option is to take that patient make sure that they're stable. And this would only work in the stable patient, but you can occlude that bleeding with the use of Foley catheter, for example, just enough not to compress anything, but to actually stop that external bleeding, and then to go to CT angio to see, is there truly a vert injury? Because if there truly is a vert injury, you know, associated with or without spinal column injury, I mean, these patients are probably best dealt with in IR. So, I think it takes a little bit more judgment to get to that point. And it's not uncommon for somebody to take that patient to the operating room, and I think that's perfectly acceptable, find that it is, in fact, a vert injury that's bleeding, and they can't get a hold of it, but they're able to temporarily occlude it, and then go to IR. But if you knew ahead of time and could confirm that on a CT angio, that would not be an unreasonable maneuver, and may in fact be the best pathway for the patient.
Well, Dr. Inaba, that was probably the best rundown of penetrating neck trauma I think I've ever heard. And it certainly covered most of the scenarios that we're going to see as trauma surgeons in the future. The next segment we're going to move into is the final five. And this is where we really try to let the listeners get to know you a little better and just little things about you. And the first question I have for you, and we ask every single guest on our podcast, is, you know, when you're in the operating room, what's on your iPod or what music are you playing?
Country music.
Country music. I love it. So is there you always be picking the music, or is the residents always dictating it?
No, in reality, we do allow the residents to you know, we got to keep the residents very happy in this era of duty hours and such. So the residents do get to pick the music in the operating room. And in the new county, we actually have a great setup. So we can stream music. It actually works really well. And I'm a big fan, I think, of keeping the atmosphere in the operating room as positive, enthusiastic, and low stress as possible. So as Don knows, even in the most crazy cases, I think it's very important for, you know, whoever is running that operation to ensure it's your responsibility to make sure everything's calm, and music can go a long way towards that. So I'm very much in favor of that in my operating room.
Yeah, very good. Low stress, relax. That's very important for pampered residents. Sir, any hobbies, talents, or interests outside of the OR or the hospital?
Yeah, it's, you know, with all this LAPD training, I don't have a whole lot of time for stuff, but I would say that the thing that I consistently turn to hobby-wise is running or riding. And so, you know, I really make a point of, you know, 5 times a week, hopefully 6 times a week, I try to get out for a run or a ride. I try to ride to work if I can. And, you know, I have an 8-year-old son, so I try to run with him. He's just getting into it now. So we try to ride or run together if we can. So,
question number 3, is there a favorite trip or vacation that you've taken recently?
You know, I travel a fair amount around the world, fortunately or unfortunately. I think my favorite city or place to go has got to be Tokyo in Japan. So, and not only because I have, you know, a lot of family there. In fact, everyone outside of my parents and my sister and her family who are in Toronto, everybody's in Japan. So I love being able to touch base with family. But it's also just a fascinating city, fascinating culture. I'd have to say, hands down, it would be Tokyo. And we try to get there at least once a year if we can.
Very good. Sir, we're going to take police officer off the list of possibilities, but what would you be doing if you were not in surgery or not in medicine?
You know, that, I would have to say, it honestly, if I could do whatever I wanted, and of course, I mean, being a professional cyclist or I mean, that would be right up there. But clearly, I'm not good enough to attain that level, because if I were, I would be doing that now. So I think that, you know, ask that question, I would probably be a chef or somebody that worked in that industry. I love eating and I love making food. It's truly what I enjoy. Not the most, but it's definitely up there. So had I been given a choice, if I wasn't doing this, that might be something that I would be doing right now.
All right. And last question, maybe it was, if you can go back in time and see yourself on the first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
Wow, there's so many things. You know, now that I'm a program director, I mean, that thought really goes through my mind a lot. You know, I don't even know. I probably have like a top 100 things that I would say. I mean, it's interesting, you know, we've been discussing and joking about duty hours a lot in Pampered Residents. You know, the first thing that comes to my mind, in all honesty, is, you know, for you guys, you get 5 to 7 years to really formally kickstart your surgical training, and you're limited by a lot of things. You know, we joke about duty hours, but you truly are limited by your duty hours. You're limited by access to patients, to the variability of cases. The first bit of advice that would pop into my head is that you should do everything possible in your 5, 6, or 7 years that you're given as a resident to become the best possible surgeon, general surgeon that you can be. Now, you know, whether you're going to go into CT surgery, for example, even if you already know that you're going to be a cardiothoracic surgeon focusing in on pediatric mitral valve surgery, I think that you should take this 5 years, 6 years, 7 years and try to be the best surgeon possible. So when you're on that hepatobiliary service, you need to be the master of the Whipple. You need to know that operation inside out. When you're on the trauma service, you should be able to be functioning at the best level that you can as a trauma surgeon. And so all of those surgical skills will help you be a much better cardiothoracic surgeon. So I think, you know, duty hours notwithstanding, you know, and all the other limitations that we have. I think as an intern, if you enter residency thinking, I want to be the best possible general surgeon, expert in all of the things that I'm going to be exposed to, that would probably be the best thing that you can do to ensure that you become a very good, competent, and actually outstanding surgeon in whatever subspecialty field you choose. So, yeah. And that would be one of, like, 100 things that I would love to tell interns. So,
all right, Kenji, two more quick questions.
Sure.
Now, not counting me, I'm off the table. Who's the best technical surgeon you've worked with or seen operate?
Ooh, that's a tough question. You know, I've been fortunate enough to work with some very talented technical surgeons. And so it's a very difficult question to answer. I think I'm very lucky that way. If you had to pin me down to one, of course, you do trump everybody, of course. But I think Dimitriadis, who both of us have operated with, has a very interesting style. He's a very rambunctious surgeon, and his hands are very difficult to follow. And yet I think the experience that he has, the volume of cases that he's operated on, that really allows him to respond to, you know, trauma's funny because nothing's planned, right? You know, there's no perfect injury to the stomach in the perfect area. He knows how to deal with everything very fluidly. So I think technically speaking, I think next to Matt Martin, of course, I would put Dimitri down as technically the most excellent surgeon that I've worked with.
All right. Well, I think you broke Carlos Brown's heart for not naming him.
And then I hope he listens to this.
and then final question, separate from technique, who's been your top mentor or surgeon that's influenced you most as a surgeon and a leader?
Wow, that's, you know, that's an even tougher. I got to say, that's very difficult. I really have had so many mentors, and you know, we were just talking about this on the car ride back from the airport, and I think, you know, I'm hedging right now, as you can see, as I'm thinking, but you know, I think this is a great question because, you know, for the residents that are listening to this, as you go on and you're looking at your first job and you're looking at where to, or even medical students deciding where to do residency, there's all the technical training that you're going to receive. There's all the lectures you're going to get, the sims you're going to do, all the textbooks you read. But the people that really guide you towards where you're going to go, what you're capable of achieving, what you should be shooting for, all that stuff comes from mentors, and working at a place and finding the right mentors really can make the biggest difference between an average career and a truly outstanding career. So I think that it's central, and I'm having a hard time coming up with one name, and I don't know if we're allowed to use the same name, but I would say that, you know, of all the people that I've worked with, again, I would say, and I bet you, Matt, you would probably say the same thing, that Dimitri is very central to not only the way that we operate technically and the decisions that we make clinically, but all of the professional attributes, you know, that range everything from how you run a group to how you communicate to, you know, what simple things like what societies to join, how to, I mean, all of those career-based things. And so, yeah, I know if I had to pick one person that's had the biggest impact on my career, yeah, I think it would be him. But, you know, I think that like many of us in academic surgery, we've had the opportunity and the benefit of the advice of multiple people that have really changed how our careers have gone. And I think we're very fortunate for that. And I think that for every young surgeon, every resident, every fellow right now looking at your first job, aligning yourself with a really good mentor and a good group of people is probably just as important as the city you're going to live in or, you know, the compensation or all of those things. In fact, you know, some might say that it trumps all those things. So great question. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Inaba, we appreciate you taking your time out of your busy schedule to join us on Behind the Knife. I know you're heading to Portland here in a little bit, and I appreciate all the great suggestions and tips and tricks that you gave us today.
Absolutely, guys. It was great meeting you. Don, it's great seeing you again, and you're doing great work here, so congratulations on that. I guess you're the number one rated surgical podcast. I think that's absolutely fantastic. I know it's a tremendous amount of work for you guys to put all these questions together and to do the actual recording, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
This is the way, you know, medical education is going in the future, so it's very important. Well done.
Thank you. Well, that does it for us today on Behind the Knife. In about a week, we'll be in Vegas at the Trauma, Critical Care, and Acute Care Surgery Conference, covering live events and interviewing attendees. So look out for that. Until next time, dominate the day.